Hi, I'm Molly Wonsall.
And I'm Geoffrey Wonsall.
And for the last 16 years or thereabouts, we've been having lunch every Saturday, and often our conversation turns to murder.
Which is what prompted us to start this true crime podcast called Blood Ties.
Hi everyone, welcome back to the Blood Ties podcast. I'm Molly Wonsall and I'm here with my father, Geoffrey Wonsall.
Hello everyone, welcome back. I have to confess that Molly looks as though she's had a week from hell.
Thanks, Dad.
She's absolutely strung out.
There have been some difficult moments this week, if I'm honest.
And you nearly cried.
I did. At one point, I did nearly cry, yeah. But I managed to hold it together.
Have you been to see anything interesting?
No, just been dealing with stressed out people.
Oh, well, there's a lot of stressed out people out there.
There's not much to see at the moment because it's the summertime.
I want to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Oh, I'm going to that this afternoon.
Oh, good for you.
I'm going to go and see it at 35mm at Barbican because I'm so cool.
Oh, my God. Well, it features places that I love, not least Musso and Frank's Grill on Hollywood Boulevard.
Oh, yeah, you took us there when we were
which
kids.
Which is one of my favourite restaurants
it
in
is
the
true.
World.
It's on at your local cinema, the Renoir, and 35mm.
And at 35mm?
Yeah.
Well,
you need to get yourself down there.
I shall take a friend.
You should go, though, because you always say to me, I'm going to go and see X, and then you never actually do.
No, that one I really will make an effort to go. Well, I haven't really been to anything this week, but I have come across a book which I think is very exciting. It's called Unbelievable, and it's by two Pulitzer Prize-winning American journalists, T. Christian Miller and Ken Armstrong. And it's a true story. A foster girl is being helped to become an adult from a project in Seattle in Washington State, and they help to get her a room, and she's 18 years old, and she reports a rape. She says a masked man broke in, bound and gagged her, raped her and left.
This has been turned into a TV series.
It is. It starts on September the 13th on
Netflix.
I've
seen the trailer on Netflix. It looks excellent.
Yeah. Well, the book is quite exceptional because what happened was she withdrew her story. She said, oh, no, actually, I wasn't. I made it all up, which then, of course, got terrible consequences. And then two detectives in another part of the country, in Denver, started investigating a similar rape account and discovered that there was actually a serial rapist out there, and that's part of the structure of the story. And you can see why Netflix would want to make it. It's got every possible ingredient, plus it's about that extraordinary characteristic of women withdrawing rape allegations when they probably shouldn't, but they browbeaten into it or feel embarrassed or all of those extraordinary things. And it's a very potent story, and yet again evidence of how close true crime
and
becomes
fiction.
Crime fiction. It's extraordinarily true.
Very true.
In this country at the moment, they're just starting on ITV a series called A Confession, which is based on a case we've actually done.
Which one?
Christopher Halliwell. And the detective superintendent in the end was forced out of the force because he didn't read him his rights when he confessed to the second murder. And it's a very, very good story.
Oh yeah, I remember we did that.
We did that. He hid the body in Savernake Forest Wiltshire. And then he took the detective to a place not far in North Leach in Gloucestershire where he'd buried another body. However, I'm about to embark on what I think is one of the most extraordinary stories I've ever covered.
Okay, so, I mean, listeners, you'll know that Geoffrey is a big fan of this person because he mentions him the whole time. And you'll also know that Geoffrey and I are big fans of the TV series Mindhunter, the new series of which just started last night on Netflix. So in honour of Mindhunter, we are doing a double bill on Ed Kemper, the co-ed killer.
Ed Kemper was born on the 18th of December 1948 He was a middle child of three. He had a younger sister and an older sister. Alan Lee was the younger and Susan was the elder. Their parents were Clarnell Stage, Clarnell Kemper as she became, and Edmund Emil Kemper II. That was Ed Kemper's dad. Edmund Kemper II, his father, was a World War II veteran who worked on nuclear testing for the Americans before returning to work in California as an electrician. Kemper's dad said that suicide missions in wartime were nothing compared to living with Clarnell, his wife.
That's harsh.
She affected him far more than he was to say later than fighting at the front. Clarnell was 27 when she had Ed Kemper the third, this is, and he was a 13-pound baby.
Whoa.
Very, very big baby.
Was that a natural birth?
Yes.
Ow.
But he had profound antisocial tendencies from a very early age. We've talked about it before. He had the classic serial killer tendencies. Let me give you two examples.
Fires, killing animals.
At the age of 10, he buried a pet cat alive.
That's really messy.
He then dug it up to see if it was dead, which it was, and decapitated it and put its head on a spike in the garden.
At the age of 10?
Yes. Okay. 3 years later, he killed another family cat and kept pieces of it in the closet in his bedroom. All we don't have is him setting fire to things. No trace of arson in here. He also performed rituals with his sister's dolls, which included, this is as he gets into adolescence, you can imagine some kind of turbulent emerging masculinity in here somewhere. He also cut the hands off the dolls and kept the pieces, again, in his room. He was, to call him troubled would be an understatement. He and his sisters, he used to play a game with his sisters called gas chamber or electric chair, when he would pretend to be electrocuted and writhe on the ground in agony. At one point, one of his sisters tried to push him under a train.
That sounds like a fun family.
And another pushed him into the deep end of a swimming pool, knowing that he couldn't swim.
Nice.
Yes, he was. It was dysfunctional, to put it politely. Clarnell despised M. Kemper's father because he said he was only an electrician and didn't do anything serious and sensible. And all. She was a domineering, neurotic alcoholic who constantly belittled her only son, Ed Kemper, and her husband, of course. She told him memorably that no woman would ever love him, and she called him persistently a real weirdo, so much so that she made him sleep in a locked basement to protect his sisters from him, and she sneered at his enormous size. He grew very, very large.
He's tall, though. He's not, like, just fat. He's, like, really big.
When he becomes a man, he's 6'9".
That's huge.
And weighs 300 pounds.
Yeah, he's just really big.
He's a really big chap.
Yeah.
Ed himself called his mother a sick, angry woman. By this point, Clarnell and his father had broken up, and at 14, Ed Kemper, the boy, ran away to go to his father, who was at that point living in Van Nuys in California, who'd remarried. But his father sent him to live with his father's parents, Maud and Ed Kemper, in North Fork. Now, to say that there was strangeness in the Kemper family is an understatement. In the end, it was a catastrophic mistake because Ed Jr. was only too aware that his grandfather, Ed Kemper I, was senile, and his grandmother was a carbon copy of Clarnell, always belittling him. So you have this deeply troubled and unhappy boy living with his father's parents, his grandparents, who is 15. His grandmother, Maud, is sitting at the kitchen table in their house. Once again, she starts to belittle him. Kemper goes upstairs to collect the rifle that his grandfather has given him, walks back downstairs and shoots Maud twice in the head, and then stabs her multiple times just to make sure she's dead.
His grandma.
Mm-hmm. Then he hears his grandfather, who's been out shopping, come back into the driveway in his car, and he's getting the groceries out of the boot, calmly walks outside and shoots his grandfather dead too. He's 15 years old.
Wow.
It is an extraordinary train of events. When he was asked, he gave himself up. He didn't pretend that he hadn't done it or say it was an intruder or anything like that. He said, I just wanted to see what it felt like to kill Grandma. I killed Grandpa so he wouldn't see what I'd done to Grandma.
Good logic.
Hmm. He didn't... He called the police himself. So he was obviously, I suppose these days we'd call it a psychotic break, wouldn't we? You know, he's just flipped. He was diagnosed, he was actually sent to the Atascadero State Hospital, where he was diagnosed as a paranoid schizophrenic, and then re-diagnosed as having personality trait disorder. But it was also discovered that at that point, at the age of 15, he had an IQ of 136. Later on, he had an IQ of 145.
Just to be clear about IQ, what's the scale from stupid to smart?
The average intelligence is 100.
Okay.
70 or below.
Mm-hmm.
To join one of these very intelligent societies, you have to have an IQ of 140 or more.
So he was like really, really smart.
He was really, really smart. He was, in Atascadero, the perfect model prisoner. I mean, he was everybody's friend. He would organise psychiatric appointments for his fellow residents. He worked in the library. He was absolutely...
Was he medicated in there?
No. It was as if he turned over a complete new leaf. He just said, oh, well, I've got it out of my system. And... at the age of 21, on his birthday, the 18th of December 1969, he's released from Atascadero. Where does he go? Where else would you think he'd go? Back to his mother. Back to his mother. He wanted to join the police. His experience in the state mental hospital was a good one, and he wanted to join the police, but they turned him down because he was too big.
Not because he'd murdered his own grandparents.
No. But you see, the other clever thing about Kemper, Clarnell at this point had remarried, it's worth pointing out. And she was living in a place called Aptos in California. She was an administrative assistant at the University of California in Santa Cruz. In 1972, Kemper's juvenile records were expunged. The psychiatrists believed he was very well adjusted, had initiative, intelligence, and was free from any psychotic issues whatever, and, more significantly, posed no danger to society. Kemper was to go on to kill 8 more people. I'm not attributing any blame to the psychiatrist, but his records were expunged.
Not the first time we've heard that happen.
No, nor will I'm afraid be the last. But one of the things that happened during this period was that he couldn't get into the police, but he became very pally with the local policemen, in particular going to a bar they used to all attend called the Jury Room in Aptos. And in that period, in 1971-72, he also had a rather nasty traffic accident. He had a motorcycle crash. Again, how often have we heard, you know, accidents in the history, early history of serial killers? It's, again, familiar. But finally, he had a girlfriend for a time, a 16-year-old.
A 16-year-old? Oh, yes. Wait, hold on. How old is he at this point?
Well, at this point, he'll be 23, 24.
Okay.
But he finally gets a job with the California Highway Department, which involves him driving round. And shortly after, his juvenile records have been expunged and he's become friends with the local police department, he embarks on a killing spree that lasts 11 months. Now, I'm sure you're going to ask me, what was the reason for that? Why did he do that? It is one of the mysteries of Ed Kemper.
And he never said, did he?
Never said.
He never said.
What he admitted at one point was that he noticed while he was driving round all these different places that there were an awful lot of young women who hitchhiked. Remember, it's a slightly different time. We're talking about 1972 into 73. The awareness of the dangers of hitchhiking were still at this point not quite as firmly established. And he starts his killing spree by picking up 2 18-year-olds on the 7th of May 1972, Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Lucchese. Kemper persuades them to get into the car.
Well, if they're hitchhiking, surely don't need persuading.
Well,
they'd look at him and think, there's a giant man, I'm not getting in the car with him.
I'm not getting in the car with him, no. Anyway, he attacks one, a Marianne, and stuffs the other one in the boot for later, so to speak. He shoots, stabs, and strangles Marianne, and then gets the other victim, Anita, out of the boot and proceeds to do exactly the same to her.
Did he sexually assault them?
Yes, but that's not perhaps the worst of it. He then proceeds to take the bodies of both young women in the boot of his car back to the room he's living in at that point. Ironically, he's stopped by a traffic cop. He's driving a Ford Galaxy and he's got a broken rear taillight. Even though he's got the bodies of 2 young women in the boot of the car, the cop doesn't ask him to open the boot. Merely gives him a ticket. Because remember, Kemper is incredibly
comes across as gregarious, very charming, polite, affable, yes, of apologetic.
Course, of course, officer, I'm so sorry, I didn't notice. I'll get it, I'll deal with it immediately. And haven't I seen you at the jury room? Or, you know, you can just see.
Oh, smart. So you think that making friends with the police officers was premeditated?
I think it was certainly in his mind. He's a very premeditated man. It doesn't appear so.
Hence the IQ of 145.
He takes the bodies back and proceeds to decapitate both women. And then has sex with the heads. I'm not going to go into details. But it actually, if you like to look it up, it's
called... No, I'm okay.
Irumatio.
Okay, thank you.
It is an unpleasant, but nevertheless, it became one of his signatures. 5 months later,
I was already feeling quite nauseous this morning.
Sorry, Ma. Sorry, darling. This is a pretty tough one. This one.
Mm.
5 months later, on the 14th of September, 1972. He offers another girl called Alice Koo, who's only 15, a lift. He does very much the same thing. I won't go into endless detail because once I've said it once, it's clear enough. But, and once again, he puts her body in the trunk of his car and takes her back to his apartment and decapitates the body. He is a necrophiliac in every way and deserves the description. There's something unbearably creepy about Kemper, because on the surface is this giant, amiable,
gentle giant.
Yeah, gentle giant, amiable, you know, good with authority, and yet, well, I think that the actor who portrays him in Mindhunter Series 1, Cameron Britton, does a remarkable job of conveying this huge man who, in the last episode of Series 1, can be very frightening, and yet all the way through is...
He talks about everything in such a calm kind of...
Yes, very, very
sort of way.
Calm
yeah.
way. In January 1973, times have got rather hard and Kemper has to go back to live with his mother, Clarnell, again. On the very day he moves back in with Clarnell, on the 7th of January 1973, he kidnaps or offers a lift to a girl called Cindy Schall, who's 18. And very much the same. Puts her in the boot of the car. But this time, he takes her body home. His mother's out. And he puts her in the closet in his room, in Clarnell's house.
How is he going to get away with this stuff?
He does.
Clarnell hasn't put him back in the basement then and locked him in.
No. At this point, he's too big to lock in the basement, really.
Oh, yeah, true.
After a brutal, heated argument with his mother on the 5th of February 1973... He offers a lift to Rosalind Thorpe and Alison Lynn, Ali Lynn, who to whom he subjects exactly the same fate. He takes their bodies back to his house, Clarnell's house, and mutilates them again. In a period of 9 months, Kemper has killed, mutilated, stabbed, obliterated 6 young women. You can imagine the impact that would have had on the local community.
Yeah, of course.
But Kemper hides in plain sight. Keeps up his job with the California Highway Department.
Goes to the jury room and hangs with the police.
Police. He is... He's exploded, literally. So he's killed his grandparents,
mm-hmm.
gone to Atascadero,
mm-hmm.
got out, had his juvenile records expunged, so they're not on... If you look him up on the database, it's not there. And entirely at random... He has killed 6 female young women. Some of them university students, some of them not. It doesn't take a genius to say that the one person all that rage was directed at...
Was his mother.
Was, of course, was his mother. Clarnell Strandberg, as she's then become... She humiliates him relentlessly. Still, even though, you know, he's grown, and she cannot stop herself. And on the night of the 20th of April 1973, Kemper gets home quite late and Clarnell's in bed reading. He goes into her room and she says, "Oh, I suppose you want to talk all night now, will you?" And Kemper, as ever, humiliated, says, "Oh, no, no, no. You go back to sleep. That's fine." And disappears. What happened next is a part of the second episode.
Very good.
Because what Kemper then does is he effectively removes the stressor, his mother. So let's come back to that and to what happens next, which is every bit as remarkable.
Okay, well, looking forward to episode two. Thank you so much, Dad. So that was part one of Ed Kemper, the co-ed killer.
So what are you doing this week? You've got something exciting happening this week.
I'm going to Edinburgh.
Oh, that's lovely.
To the festival.
Very good. See a few comedy shows.
And also a bit of circus. You know how I love
circus. Oh, circus, yes.
Listeners, I can't remember if I've talked about this before.
My
but
father
a real
loved
for
the circus. He absolutely adored the circus.
Hey, you know, I could... oh, no, you're going away at Christmas. Oh, I could still take you to that good circus that's on at Christmas. I might do that for your Christmas present.
Yes. But what am I doing this week? I'm not going to Edinburgh. I don't know. Yet more books, I suppose. Sometimes the sheer torrent of them overwhelms. As you know, I review crime and thrillers for the Daily Mail in England, and it never stops. And the trouble is, and I say this against myself, that I've now seen every single conceivable plot.
No new setups.
There's very, very... It does have to be really remarkable.
For it to really...
I mean, you can see most of it from about a million miles away.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's always the... Oh, it's the evil sister, or I'm trying to find my son.
Yeah,
or
I can imagine it's hard to find ones that are, like, more interesting.
It's not that they're not all well written, and not that some of them aren't very good. I'm very lucky. I read some wonderful, wonderful books. But there is a limit to how much... I got into one this week by a very well-known writer called P.J. Tracy. It was originally a mother and daughter team, but then the mother died and the daughter went on her own. It's called P.J. Tracy. And this was a book called Ice Cold Heart, about a serial killer. The trouble is, it then got incredibly confusing because this serial killer was actually a war criminal who'd escaped from the Balkans or Bosnia and gone to live in America and was a monster. And it became kind of... It's very well done, and P.J. Tracy's an excellent writer, but I became overwhelmed by it. You know, I'm struggling to find, you know, follow the plot.
Was it like when you read Tolstoy and you have to keep looking in the index for who's who because everyone's got five names?
No, not quite as bad as that, although that was always what got me down about Russian fiction.
Yeah, you're not a man for Russian fiction.
No, I mean, all those diminutives are just...
The thing is, everyone's got five names, so then they'll start referring to someone else, and you'll be like, who's that? And then look in the thing, like, oh, it's so-and-so.
Well, considering I did Russian government as part of my final degree...
I'm a fan of Russian literature.
I should know a bit more about it, but I can only remember things like Lenin's real name was Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. You know,
useful what we retain from our student days.
What can we retain? But it's been fascinating week again. I think I've got some more documentaries to plan, and of course got some more podcasts.
More podcasts to plan. Yes, exactly. Well, that's very good. All right, Dad. Well, thanks so much, and we will be back next week with part two of Ed Kemper.